Welcome back to Beauty Rest USA Radio. This is your host, Yashida, and I have missed you dearly. It's been a while. We have been getting life together, we'll say that, and then preparing for our launches at the end of 2020. It's going to be a very exciting year, a lot of new content being produced consistently, so shout out to the startup life. So without further ado, happy 2020. Happy Black History Month, and we'll get into it. So today, our topic is going to be about climate gentrification. And with this, we'll tap a lot into the disaster relief and economics of Puerto Rico before and after the storm. We'll talk a little bit about some of the comparisons with disaster relief with Harvey, with Katrina, and with Maria itself. Also, we'll talk a lot about the aftermath and privatization of culture. And I have to say that because there is culture dwelling where your economics lay the head at night. You know, it's you see gentrification and you think just white people moving into a neighborhood and taking advantage of people who could barely afford to live in a place they were already pushed out to. But gentrification can be many things. It can be two people of the same ethnic background, you know, working together, living together in the same neighborhood, but they belong to two different social standings, right? That could be part of gentrification in a neighborhood. It could be how in Little Havana, we had a mostly Cuban, historically Cuban neighborhood as a historical and political movement, or I would say place and time or happening or whatever, I don't know, for lack of better words. But now you see a lot of Central Americans moving in. So it's been almost like the culture has been infused. And I think the state of culture needs to be discussed when we talk about economics, because how things are depicted in the media, you know, you get told a very condensed version of what may or may not be just part of the truth. You know, there definitely needs to be more alternative news that is inclusive, and of course that's why we're here. Anyway, so I went and picked up a book from Karis Books and More. For those of you who don't know, I love to shop indie bookstores only. I don't buy books off of Amazon anymore. And it's been that way for some time now. I think it's healthy for the economy. Those of you who are really into the No Name Book Club, like, get into it, be at your local bookstores. If you're in Atlanta, the best places I go are Karis Books and More, which, like I said, is the oldest feminist bookstore in the South. And then there is For Keeps, which is a rare African-American bookstore. And I try to, like, every time that I'm traveling, I try to find indie bookstores and find what I can get there and make connections. But if you know that there's a specific content and you don't want that, you want to read, if you know the bookstore has it, if you don't, like, order it to the bookstore, because then you can just go pick up what you want and then they will start ordering more things that they know you will buy. Anyway, so this book touches a lot on the economics of Puerto Rico. And I will say the last time that I went to PR before the hurricane was 2005. So when I was seeing it, it really hit home for me when I saw it in 2018 doing disaster relief work. Because before, people really believed that we were a tax safe haven because you get so many tax breaks on your capital gains, all of that, bringing your business to PR, bringing jobs, because really the only thing sustaining the economy there at the time, and even now barely, is these foreign companies coming in and giving everyone jobs and then providing money for the GDP, right? Which to them, based on the size of the company, is really nothing because you're getting all of these tax breaks. But it gives jobs, and then tourism gives the circulation of money as well. And then you have your government jobs, but your government is extremely dependent on mostly your GDP, but really a lot on the U.S. So, you know, at this time, jobs were there. Schools were, they were decently funded compared to how they are now, for sure. And to see people who really trusted the system be so impoverished when I came back, talking to some of the kids, like, of course, I'm not from PR. My mom is from PR, so I didn't grow up there. But from the things that I've known, like, from dealing with my mom, and then just from the times that I've been there, like, I could see a drastic difference, like, especially with the youth. Like, so many kids are getting caught up in the Dominican cartel right now because, you know, there's no food. And, like, there's no infrastructure. Like, if you live in Carolina or one of these places where it's more residential, I guess if you want to call it suburban, I wouldn't really say that because most of these people are broke. There's not much to do except for, like, go to church and go to school if it hasn't shut down, you know, and go to the corner store, that kind of thing. Those buses take, like, 2 hours to get somewhere. And then it's like, that's the best that the infrastructure has to offer outside of tourism. And when you go, and I got to see Canovanas, I got to see Luisa, I got to see Rio Piedras and Carolina, yeah, and then of course San Juan proper. And of course this is mostly like cities surrounding the capital, but you can only imagine how there's no healthcare for people who live in the mountains and things upon that nature. And just looking at some of the facts, we have suicides increased 28% in 2017. And then, you know, suicide prevention hotlines doubled from September 2017 to March 2018. Groups are working with, and you know, educational programs, and to have all of those things, those resources cut because your infrastructure is not set up how it's supposed to, let alone there's no money for schools, there's no money for this, no money for that. You would think that because there's just not enough money, or because the government is being poorly funded or misusing funds, that, you know, that's just an unfortunate reality. But then when you compare it to the money and the support that's getting sent to other hurricane relief projects, like for Harvey or for Katrina, and you look at these think tanks, there are actual, you know, structural things in place for people to recover. And you know, there is the PROMESA bill. And of course that in Puerto Rico means that, like, all of the debt that we have to repay it back. Period. But then what are you supposed to do when you don't even have money and now you have to pay the COFINA board, who is basically the people that have been grouped together to restructure all of this debt. And that's getting paid out of the Puerto Rican taxpayers' money. Taxpayers who don't have any money to pay taxes. And just to put, like, a good stamp on the reality of things, you can have a Republican think tank take a look at how to restructure for Katrina, right? And I lived in New Orleans, so I got to see how small businesses actually change things. Now, there is a big debate on the racial divide and the racial gentrification with climate change, and we'll tap into that. But there were actual think tanks behind that. And there's a big question that comes with being fiscally conservative, whether you're a Republican or Democrat, because if you're really being fiscally conservative, you have to ask for who. And to think that that's mutually exclusive with being Republican, Republican is a big mistake. So we're looking at, in March 2018, FEMA had approved $141.8 million in individual assistance to Harvey victims versus $6.2 million to those affected by Maria and PR. And it happened 9 days after. Okay, after the event. The Houston population right now is, well, at the time, the Houston population at the time was 6 million. PR's population was 3.4. Now, as far as a place where you think you can get all of your companies back, and for the place that's considered such a tax haven, you would think that it would be an investment to rebuild the infrastructure for the people there so that they could work and work for these jobs. But obviously, it's a lot more of a commodity to just wipe everything clean and then come in and own all of that land. And that's a big part of the problem, is that because COFINA and the PROMESA bill and all those things can be a structure that you have or something to put on a face, the reality of put on a face of actually solving the problem. The reality of solving the problem is that what happens when your government can't pay back the debt, these companies start coming in privatizing things. They privatize your airport, they privatize your public transit, they privatize everything. So now it's not only oh, this is a tax haven. No. Now we're going to own most of your land. Now we're going to own most of your public infrastructure. And that, I think, is a political scheme. You know, it's intentional and it's done on purpose. When we look at 5.1 million meals versus 1.6 NPR, that's what Houston got versus what PR got. In Houston, there was 4.5 million liters of water, 2.8 million liters of water in PR. We have 20,000 tarps in Houston versus 5K NPR. It took 10 days to approve permanent disaster relief in Houston, Texas versus 43 days in Puerto Rico. And while we're looking at the quality of living, we're looking at PR's minimum wage at $7.25, 88% of the median wage. You have 40% of students requiring SPED services and only 13% qualify. You have, again, talking about privatization, in typical American, I guess, idealism of capitalism, there's the more you can privatize things, or even with small business, you know, how the Republican think tanks thought to restructure for Katrina with don't open public schools just yet. Give private school vouchers and charter schools to these students. And there's a bunch of kids still to this day walking around in their private school uniforms in New Orleans, right? Then you're closing the housing projects and making tax-free enterprise zones for people to come and rebuild. You have the idea that maybe you'll just do open wildlife and oil drilling. Like, there's all of these ideas that are coming to fund in and privatize. Whether they're sustainable or not is a big conversation for another time. But you have this going on. And meanwhile, to go to UPR, which is the University of Puerto Rico, if you don't know, you have to consider that 10% of public colleges are affordable. And once that's privatized, think about the state of UPR. Think about the state of social mobility for Puerto Ricans with a degree. Then, you know, 64% of UPR students are low income. And then you have to also know that because of Maria, $500 million is cut to the university. And you are also considering campus consolidation. In rankings of the worst social economy in the world right now, you had number one with Zambia, and then you have South Africa and PR. That's the reality of things. That's the reality of our citizenship, is just being colonized with the privilege to come over here. And after we've, put in all our savings into these broken bonds? So the question is, now that we've seen the results of Katrina, now that we've seen the results of Hurricane Harvey in Houston, Texas, and if you want to talk about Sandy and all of these other ones, we've seen some of the numbers. Now let's talk about when the sea levels start to rise again. Because right now in Miami, Little Haiti is getting gentrified. There are plenty of places in Miami and all over the U.S. where historically these immigrant populations were pushed out to these areas, and now they're living, you know, over time, the housing market goes up. But when they were living there, a lot of them chose to buy their homes, and they're getting, you know, constant reminders of, I'll pay this for your home, I'll pay this for your home, knowing that the market is going to go up and they're going to make way more than what they bought that home for. And for those families to repurchase in the same market, it's not a good sale, and there's nowhere for them to invest because there's nowhere for them to sustain that quality of life that is now getting pushed into the area. You have people going from the coast, or, you know, closer to the bay, trying to go to where Little Haiti is because of the elevation levels. You know, it starts with the natural disaster, and then you have big projects from these big companies like arenas or new housing, condos and things like that start getting built around your neighborhood, and the next minute you know you're not safe anymore. So I say all of that to hopefully give you some perspective on, first of all, there's the idea that you should buy your home, but I think for more geared towards people who are considering development projects, you have to look at the actual cost of living. Not just that, for the people who are going to live there, not just the people that you want to pay you to live there, or people that you want to sell your homes to, but if a city starts to run out of housing, the whole real estate market itself is going to suffer because you can't buy and sell houses when people don't have places to live because you have overpopulated so many of these areas just based on the fact that you knew that you were tired of paying your insurance for living for building so close to the sea. And there's, you know, the housing index, or you have to ask yourself, in certain cities, even if there isn't, you know, climate gentrification that's on the brink, is it more affordable? Do we have enough space? How much can this actual zip code afford to build housing and to sell housing before we have to start finding sustainable ways for renters? And if you do not consider that, then everybody is going to pay for inflation. And I think it starts with thinking about when people of color start purchasing their homes, even though you have pushed them out of their countries through world trade or pushed them out of their countries through colonization, you know, those kind of things, or push them out of their neighborhoods through gentrification and that route, if you take that, or taking away jobs, those things. Once you can no longer gentrify a neighborhood with just white people who have money, you start having to think about how locally your resources can be distributed. Because if a person who cannot afford to sell their home doesn't sell and lives there, there's going to be plenty of people that are not going to move. And yes, you can push them out by making things way too expensive, but then you push them out to another city that you're going to gentrify later. So hope that we've brought you some perspective on not only climate change, not only disaster relief, but to consider sustainable living, not even just being vegan, but just purchasing power. Because whether you have $1 or $1 million, the truth is that even though there are people that are coming to gentrify a neighborhood, those people are a lot closer to being poor than these people who are, you know, benefiting from the new Trump tax bill and not paying taxes, even though there's a significant difference in the amount of income that they have per year. So with that, I hope you guys stay woke, and thank you so much for listening to Beauty Rest USA. Happy Beauty Rest.